We now come to our speaker for the evening. This little lady has the most ability of any lady, I might say, in the world, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. This vibrant little lady serves as the epitome of all those in the Fellowship who feel that a lifetime of sobriety is unobtainable. Would you all please join me in welcoming Sybil C.
Thank you, Ray. Well, this is Grandma Moses on the road again. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. I just talked to the Corwin husband an hour ago. I told him that I was just getting ready to leave for this meeting, and I've been looking forward to this a long time. A lot of people here. A lot more than I really hadn't any idea what was going on up here. Every month, right? Once a month. No? Can you hear me? Once a year. Okay. I bet you could pull them in here once a month. Seems to me like AA's love to go, you know? And that was my great fear when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that it would wear off and that I wouldn't want to go. Because everything in my life, I'd meet with great enthusiasm. Oh, isn't that wonderful? And after about 2 weeks, I'd drop it like a hot potato. Nothing lasted, really, you know? And I was so afraid that AA would wear off and I'd get bored, and that I wouldn't stay with it. And that's not so. I find that it gets better all the time. Now, by that, I don't mean that anything changes as far as our program is concerned, the steps or the traditions or the meetings. But we have such a variety of meetings that nowadays we can pick and choose. You know, I mean, if you want to go to a sit-down book study, which I like very much. We have one every Monday night. Bob and I like to attend about, it started out with, there were 13, I think, a dozen, maybe 11. And we would talk about the book. We'd read something from it and discuss it. And then it got up to 18 and 20, and we still continued to go to it. And it got up to 30 and 35, and it got so big we quit going because it just got too big for a discussion group, and a lot of people were left out. But that's a fine kind of a meeting. Now, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this way. I had heard of it once, briefly, in 1939. Picked up a little magazine at my mother-in-law's home. She was a saint, if there ever was one. She lived in San Diego. I go down there on the train and visit her occasionally, and she'd visit us. And I picked up the Liberty magazine, and in it, it had a little piece about AA called Alcoholics and God. And I read it. I don't remember exactly what it said, but there was one sentence in there that grabbed me. It said that there were a few men in New York who met regularly, weekly, because of their common problem, and that it was helping them. And they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not all of it, but that's the gist of it that I remembered all those years, that there were some men in New York meeting for mutual sobriety, and that they were doing that. And it impressed me a lot. And I had been so uncomfortable and miserable about my drinking for so many years, but defiantly denying it to anybody who told me I was drinking too much, especially my brother. He was on me all the time about my drinking. And then I always got to say, what about you? What about you? They put you in jail. They always turn me loose. Which they did. The cops would stop me when my car was driving crookedly, and they'd make me park it. They'd drive me home, or they'd call my husband, and he'd come and get me, and they just didn't throw me in jail. Now, that was a long time ago. They throw the gals in jail regularly for that now. But I was just lucky that I didn't kill someone or kill myself, and they were always very nice to me. Now, you might say it was so strange that I started drinking anyway when Papa... we lived in Texas until I was a teenager, in a little bitty town that's not there anymore, and then we moved to Waco after that, and they were very churchy people, and they were all baptized in the Christian church, and when I was old enough, I was baptized in the Christian church and went to Sunday school, and Papa always said he'd never let me go out with the boys until I was 18 or married. Well, he had married my mother when she was 15. And he says, you'll never leave this house with a boy until you're 18 or married. So when I was 15, I got married so that I could leave the house. And Jimmy was just like a brother to me. He really was, just a wonderful guy. And then I was introduced to my first drink, which was, oh, I heard Papa talk by the hour, by the day, by the week, by the month, by the year, about booze, and he was against it. I mean, he would say things like this. He was a great talker. He'd be talking to somebody who would say, Mr. Adams, how do you feel about drinking? Well, sir, let me tell you how I feel about drinking. If a rattlesnake bit me on my arm right here, and I would know that it was dangerous and would probably kill me, but if a man walked up to me with a pint of whiskey and said, Mr. Adams, let me pour a little dram of that whiskey on that snake wound and it'll heal instantly, Papa would say, no, sir, don't you touch me with that stuff. You just get a dull knife and cut my arm off up to the shoulder here and that'll be all right, but don't touch me with that whiskey. Well, now, a little girl hearing that would get curious. I wondered what that stuff was like. I wondered. I really did wonder. I'd never seen any, smelled any, sniffed any, or anything else. And I had to quit high school there in California after we moved out there. I had to quit early because my parents were poor and I needed to get a job, which I did. And I worked at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in a factory there, and they all drank. And so they passed me a drink one day after work. They all went out on the baseball diamond there, and they had a little kind of a picnic celebration. After, in between shifts, and when they passed me the bottle, I drank the whole thing. I was so anxious to see what it tasted like. What was left in that bottle, I drank. Well, now, a kid who would never have had a drink, you'd know what happened. I just fell down on the ground, on the grass there, just unconscious. And they had to call my father and mother to come and get me. Oh, the humiliation of waking up in my mother's bed and knowing how Papa felt about whiskey. I wanted to die. I really, really did. And I cried and cried and cried and begged forgiveness and said, I don't know how it happened. It'll never happen again. I give you my solemn oath. It'll never happen again. And then finally they said, that's all right, baby. You just made a mistake. And they were very tender about it, and they forgave me. And I went on back to work, and I got drunk that week and the next week and kept it up until I was married and then kept it up. And he was just like a brother. He would take care of me and haul me home. He didn't drink much, maybe one, maybe none, maybe two. He just didn't care about it. And I wondered why that I did that. Even then, I had a bad case of guilt. And I would even say to myself, not to him, I didn't want to voice it, I'm not going to drink at this party. And it was always homemade wine or home brew, which can really knock you out. It's so much stronger than the beer you buy today. And I never did drink it in moderation. I always got drunk. And my hangovers were just bad, really bad. And as far as I know, and I could be mistaken, but as far as I know, I never went longer than 9 days without a drink. If anybody offered me a drink, I'd drink. My brother Tex, who was 10 years older than I, began to bootleg. He was a bootlegger there during the Depression. And Tex and I'd sit around in that apartment of his where he served booze, and we'd drink up our own stock to where we didn't have hardly any to serve anybody when they came in and wanted to drink. And I wasn't happy with it, but I was rebellious, and I wouldn't allow them to know that I wondered what was wrong. Well, that marriage that I told you about didn't last very long, and I went to work for an attorney. The attorney that got me my divorce offered to hire me as his secretary. And I had taken a course in high school being a secretary, and I was a good one. But it didn't stop the drinking. Now, the word alcoholism, I don't know. We know it had been invented at some time, but I had never heard the word. And then I began to hear my folks talk about poor grandpa dying drunk on my mother's side. Her name was Jones, and Grandpa Jones used to have a little grocery store down in Simmons, Texas, and before that in Alfred, Texas. Simmons is gone. Alfred may still be there. I don't know. But I know I would go down to that little grocery store, walk down the trail, and go in Grandpa's store, and he would always pick me up and throw me up in the air and catch me and call me his little Goldilocks, and sometimes he'd be so jolly and so much fun that I would just hang around there just to be with Grandpa. And other times, I would go in the store, and he'd say, "I'm busy. I'm busy, baby. You go home now. Go see your mama. I'm busy." Well, I didn't know that those times that he was so jolly that Grandpa was drunk. I didn't know until I was 21 that he died an alcoholic. I mean, my folks were so strange about this business of not even admitting that a member of their family had died of alcoholism. And so I didn't know that my dear Grandpa died of booze. And I knew that I drank and I had two brothers. Clyde lives in Dallas, Texas. Clyde is 5 years older than I am, and Tex was 10 years older. And Clyde never did anything wrong in his life. He went to work young. He didn't finish his education. He began to build race cars for the Indianapolis Speedway, and he built them for all the well-known names, and he was talented in that direction. Never had alcohol in the house. His wife was very much opposed to it. And they had three sons. And those three sons are living, middle-aged fellows. They have never done anything wrong in their lives. They have never had anything but great success. They married beautiful ladies who have never had a drink, and they've never had a drink, and neither has my brother Clyde or his wife. And I visit them once or twice a year. And they know that I'm in AA, and when I stop off for a day or two to see them in Dallas, my brother invariably will say, "Are you still going to that AAA?" And I'll say, "Yes, Clyde, I am." And his wife, Muriel, will say, "Well, she didn't have to go. I never saw her take a drink in my life. She just went with her big brother, Tex, that's all, because he was a no-good drunk." And, of course, I was right along there drinking with my brother, Tex. But they don't understand, so I never would see any point when I go to Dallas to talk about drinking or not drinking or AA or anything else. Never been to a meeting in Dallas because I only spend a few days with them and they don't know anything about it and don't want to know anything about it. And that's the way it is with some people. They're not too much informed about the fact that alcoholism is a killer of great magnitude, and that there are people all over this great land of ours and overseas that still don't know about AA yet, but are finding out about it. And we're growing very rapidly because it is the most successful thing that has come down the pike since day one. I mean, there is nothing like AA to help people get sober. And I have had so many people that were reluctant to join at first because they thought that they would be thrown in with a crowd that wouldn't fit in with their thinking or something or other. And then weeks or months or later, I might go over to Covina or Santa Ana, Orange County or someplace, and there they stick, they're members. And so they too belong. They gradually come around to that way of feeling. And the publicity that we get now is fabulous. I mean, I've never read a piece in a newspaper or a magazine that panned AA and said that it was no good. I think universally that the world thinks that we're doing a good job. And I think we are. Now, I came in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1941, and I was very lucky, believe it. I was born in 1908, which makes me 77 now, going on 80. This coming month, in May, I will be 78 years old. And in March, which is coming up pretty soon, I will be sober 45 years. I didn't say that to take credit for it, because, believe me, I could do no better. I could do no better alone. I could do no better with my family. I couldn't do any better with a little baby that I adored, my little daughter when she was born, with all the earnestness that I could feel. I held her in my arms and I said, "Your mama's not going to drink anymore, baby. You're not going to have to put up with this any longer. I've got you now, and I'll never drink again." Well, it wasn't 3 weeks, 2 weeks, or whatever, that I had to be hauled home and put in my mother's bed, and they took that baby away from me, and I couldn't have her. I adored her, and I just couldn't... They did the right thing. They truly did. I could visit her and take her home with me for a few hours, but I just wasn't able and wasn't capable of guaranteeing that I wouldn't get drunk and not take care of her. So now I see that that's all right. They did the right thing. She lives in Hollister and raised five kids, my grandchildren. And my grandchildren have raised children, so I'm a great-grandmother. And my little baby is now 54, going on 55, and has 4 years sobriety. But she wouldn't tell me. I didn't know that. I had no idea, because Bob and I would drive up to Hollister, which is 300 or 325 miles from where we live, and we'd go up there a few times a year, and the little kids would all line up out in front. She had five of them, and there they were, little, just cute as they could be. I just adored them. And I'd go in her home, and I felt badly that I was such a poor housekeeper, because, Addie, everything was waxed, everything was shiny, everything was immaculate. She was a good cook. A marvelous cook, always had such a beautiful, clean house. And I thought, who does she take that from? I'm a rotten housekeeper. I can't do that. Never have and don't even want to tell you the truth. And everything was just perfect. Well, I was in Grants Pass, Oregon 4 years ago and doing what I'm doing right now. And when I got back to my motel, there was a note on the door. And it said, call your husband in Los Angeles. It's urgent. I thought, oh, my God, he's had a heart attack, because Bob does have angina. And I went in there, and I called up, and I said, "What is it? What is it, Bob? Is anything wrong? Are you all right, dear? Do you have to go back to the hospital or anything?" He said, "No. Your daughter Addie called me tonight and said she got her 30-day chip." I said, "What for? She never had a drink." And he says, "Well, she said that for 13 years she'd been battling it, and she was ashamed to let us know it because we were in AA, and she was brought up in an AA home from the time that she was at a high, and that having the house full of AAs playing cards and talking AA and home meetings, and she just thought it was a bad thing that she got the disease being so full of AA and going to the meetings with me so much. And here she turned into a drunk. And I was the last to know that she went to AA. I don't understand it, but it's okay. And now she and I go to meetings together when she comes down to Los Angeles to visit me every 3 or 4 months. She just can't wait to go to the meetings, and I'm extremely proud of her. And she's a beautiful girl, not just because of my mama, but she really is a beautiful girl. At 54, she looks like she's about 35. But I have a granddaughter, her firstborn, who is 33 years old now, and that's the age I was when I quit drinking. And she is a dead ringer for me, with the exception that April is on dope and booze. And I was on booze and would have taken dope if I'd known about it, I'm sure. And I have talked to April about it, in a way not to say, "Come on here, you go with me to the meeting in Hollister tonight." I wouldn't do a thing like that, you know. But any time that the word AA is mentioned, she says, "Well, I don't have to go. I don't drink too much." And maybe her mother has just called me in Los Angeles and said that the cops had put her in the pokey again. And one night she had a little kid, you know, and one night they came and picked her up and took her over to my daughter's home. It's a little town, and they all know everybody. And took the little kid over there and said, "Now, the next time that your daughter screws up, we're going to throw her in jail, and we're not going to bring her over here for you to sober her up. And next time, that's the way it's going to be." Well, she's still doing it. And when I go up there to visit, I don't mention it to her, because all I could do would be to pull her away from any thought of ever wanting to quit drinking. Grandma comes to town and is trying to make me quit drinking. No, sir, you can't do that. I can't do that with my neighbors next door where I live now. It's just something that I believe if people had tried to talk me into, I would have been so stubborn I wouldn't have listened to them. It had to come about that I was so tired of it myself secretly and was doing the best I could, but wouldn't tell anybody that I got in my car, was a driving drunk, and by that time I was a real estate broker, one of my better jobs. And at one time I was a taxi dancer for a few days, and that wasn't one of the better jobs. And I was bootlegging with my brother for a little while, and that wasn't so hot. But I was a legal secretary, and could do many things. One time I got in my car, and I didn't mean to go anywhere, really. I just stopped at a bar, and I kept going, and I finally got over the ridge route, which was a muddy trail then. It wasn't a very good place. And I wound up at daylight in San Francisco, and it was foggy, and I was out of liquor, and I wondered why I was there. And I started crying, and I thought, I don't know what to do. I can't talk to anybody about this, and I don't dare go home because my husband will have gone, and he will take the baby. He said the next time I turned up missing that he was going to take the child and leave, and he will, too. So if I go home, I haven't got a home. I know I haven't got a home to go to. I drove back very sorrowfully, wondering what I would bump into. I got halfway across the ridge, doing the best I could with this terrible hangover, and a hitchhiker, a middle-aged man, raised his hand for a ride. And in those days, that's exactly what it was, someone wanting a ride. There weren't so many people out doing a lot of mischief. And I pulled over, and this man got in the car, and I said, "Can you drive?" And he said, "Yes." So I crawled in the back seat and curled up and went to sleep. I slept. I was out of it. Total stranger. And turned out all right, see? It turned out okay, because next thing I know, he's shaking me. And he said, Lady, we're in Los Angeles. Here's where I'll leave you. Now, you have to be able to drive yourself home. He said, you've had a good long sleep, and I'm leaving you right now. So I opened my purse, and I gave him a $5 bill or something, and thanked him. And I was parked there at 6th and Hill. And I happened to look up, putting off going home because I thought it would be empty and my little girl would be gone with my husband. And I saw this huge sign that took up those two spaces between those poles. And it said Turkish Bath, Sultan Turkish Baths. And I had read somewhere that you could sober up with a Turkish bath, that it would help sober you up. And so I thought, well, I'll go in there and get straightened up and put on some makeup and comb my hair and go home and stay there all night, and it'll give me time to cook up one more believable good lie. If he's home, he'll believe it, but I can't think now. And there, while I was looking at all this and deciding I would go, there was a newsstand just about the length of this table. And it was stacked with various newspapers and magazines. And I thought, I'll go crazy down there. After the Turkish bath, I'll have all night until morning thinking about what to say and making up stories to tell and wondering if they're there. And I can't stand it. I'll have to get something to read. So I threw down a nickel, and that tells you what year it was, and picked up a Saturday Evening Post. And I went downstairs with it and had the Turkish bath. And I picked up the Saturday Evening Post, and I got the biggest shock of my life. It was dated March 1st, 1941. And on the cover, down at the bottom, it said Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. I looked at that, and even in my rum-dum condition, I thought, this is a miracle. Here, 2 years ago in 39, I read a brief little thing by Fulton Alzheimer called Alcoholics and God, and now here's a magazine featuring it. So I took the magazine, had the Turkish bath, and I couldn't wait to open it to see what they were going to say about this AA hospital. I had the idea absolutely firmly entrenched in my mind that it was an AA hospital where maybe you went in and they vaccinated you with something and said, you're all fixed up, little lady. You can go home now. You don't ever have to drink again. I thought maybe it would be something like that. I didn't care. Whatever it was, I would have done it. And so I turned to that page, and what gave me more of an idea that it was a hospital, it showed an ambulance at a curb, and they had a stretcher with a very sick, drunk man on it, and they were putting him in the ambulance. And I thought, oh, so that's it. It's an AA hospital. They'll take this poor man over there to that AA hospital and cure him. And so then I turned the next page, hadn't read a word yet. And there was this full-page picture of the same man in the hospital bed, and sitting by him were two AA members, of course. Two men. They were sitting there talking to him. And I thought, well, that's okay. That'll be fine. I'll have to find out where this hospital is, and I'll just get cured, too. So I rang the bell for the attendant there at the Turkish bath, and I had her bring me the necessary ingredients to write. I knew me. I procrastinated so much in my life that if I owed a gas bill or electric bill or a phone bill or anything else, I would never get it paid because I wouldn't have a stamp. Or if I had a stamp, I didn't have an envelope. Or if I had a stamp and an envelope, I wouldn't have the paper. And so they just stacked up there because I never could get all the ingredients together. And this time I thought, if I don't do it now, I'm going to die. So I rang the bell for the attendant and asked for writing materials, and he brought them. And I don't know exactly what I said, because I didn't know I was going to be here telling about it. No, I saved the letter. But I didn't save the letter. I never thought it was important. And I said, I'm a desperate woman alcoholic, and I don't want to behave like this, and I don't want to drink anymore, but I can't seem to help myself. So please tell me where your AA hospital is in New York, and I'll take the next plane back there and take your cure. And something like that, pretty close. And it was received and answered by Ruth Hawk, whom I saw in Montreal. She talked Friday night there. Answered. She was 24 years old then. She came out to Los Angeles to talk to us a couple of times, and I asked her, I said, how old were you when you got my letter? And Ruth Hawk was Bill Wilson's secretary. To those of you who know the story of Bill and Hank Parkhurst, they had a little auto accessories business before they got the idea of AA, and they weren't making any money, and they paid her $25 a week to do the typing and the mail, but they didn't have the money, so they sold her stock in AA later on, according to her words. And so she was the one that answered my mail. And I asked her in Montreal, where she spoke Friday night, I said, how come I got an answer so quickly? Because the Saturday Evening Post brought in hundreds upon hundreds, possibly thousands, of responses like mine. Well, she said, your letter came early on when I was only getting 10 or 15 letters a day, and I could answer them. And then it got up to 400 and 500 letters a day, and I had to have a staff of volunteers there for about a month because so many people wrote in about AA. And I said, well, thank God you answered mine quickly. And I could still see her handwriting and her signature just as plainly. I wish I'd saved the letter. Oh, I'd give anything in the world if I'd saved that letter. It said something like this: you don't have to come back to New York to find help from Alcoholics Anonymous because you have AA in California now. It started December the 19th, 1939, four sick alcoholics in the general hospital lying in the wards there got to talking, and their stories were pretty similar, and they were there until they got well enough to be discharged, and then when they stood on the street out there in front, they were reluctant. They stood there on one foot and the other and said, well, so long, Sam, so long, Joe, or whatever their names were. I guess we won't be seeing each other. And another one said, well, I don't see why not. You can come over to my house Friday night. And the other one had the big red book under his arm because they'd been reading it to each other in the hospital. And the way they got it was another miracle. A gal by the name of Kay Miller, whose husband was an alcoholic in New York, didn't make the program but still had the book. And she brought it with her on the way to Hawaii, and she stopped off in Los Angeles and gave it to a judge who turned it over to the general hospital, and that's the way the big red book got to California. And these drunks had read it, and were interested, truly. And now they wanted to read more about it, especially how it works. And so when they would read to each other, they'd say, "What'll we read out of this book?" And one of them would say, "Well, let's read how it works. That's the whole thing right there. It'll tell us how it works, so let's just read how it works." And it got started reading that. That's what we do to this day, and most everywhere they do that. And so they said, "Well, all right, I'll meet at your house next Friday, and you meet at my house next Friday, and we'll do that for a while," which they did. But they grew to the point that they needed more room, because other people like myself had written about the Saturday Evening Post. So they met in the Cecil Hotel lobby, and they met there a while. Then they moved to another hotel lobby, and then they moved to the Elks Temple. Now, that's where I came in. They had been growing, and they had moved a couple of three times. And Ruth told me in her letter, she said, "Please go down and see them on Friday night, because they meet once a week at 8:30. And they meet at the Elks Temple at the present time." And, of course, she gave me the address of it. It was opposite Westlake Park, which is now MacArthur Park. And she said, "They will be so happy to see you, because, you see, they've never had a woman alcoholic. And you'll be more than welcome." So that's what I did. I went down there the following Friday night. My non-alcoholic husband, who was just about to divorce me anyway, was glad to do anything. We actually thought that maybe they would just give me a little bottle of medicine or, a shot in the arm or something or other. We never thought of it as an ongoing thing. It was just some kind of a cure, we thought. Now, she did enclose a pamphlet. It was the first pamphlet that AA had, and it was not thin and skinny like ours are today. It was more like 8x9, flat, white. And it had two A's on the front of it, and I do remember that when I turned the cover, and that's as far as I got, it says, "We now have AA in Houston." Now, you see, that didn't get me sober. I didn't read any further. I didn't turn to read the steps or anything else. "We now have AA in Houston." So we can say that AA started early on, and probably 1940 or 1939 in Houston. That's all I ever got out of that pamphlet. So I wasn't reading the pamphlet. I didn't know anything about the program or anything else. And when my non-alcoholic husband, dressed up like a senator, very studious looking with glasses, took me down there to the mother group. And when we went in, I was frightened so badly and embarrassed because I had a nervous tic, which I couldn't control the last 3 months of my drinking. I'd just be sitting there talking to you just as nice in a bar, wishing you'd buy me a drink, and my lip would go twitch. And I just hated it. But I never could tell when it was going to do it. And I'd just be talking away, you know, and he'd buy me another drink, and my lip would jerk. And it did for 3 months after I got sober. It would still do that little jerk. And it just humiliated me more than you imagine. Tears would come in my eyes, and I couldn't comb my hair, and it's terribly heavy, and that's why I've always cut it short. So when we went down to that meeting, I wore an old flannel, or kind of sort of like flannel, red turban, so that I could stuff my hair. I had a permanent. They were rotten permanents in those days, kinky. My hair long and thick, and I put all my hair up under that red turban, and my bloodshot eyes, oh boy, did I look like something. The cat dragged in. Went down to the Elks Temple, and that's a lovely place, and we asked at the desk there where the AA meeting was, and he said right over there in that room. It was a dining room, and we went in, and there were about a dozen fellows sitting there, and I just made myself as invisible as I could. But Frank Randall was about the most eloquent man that I've ever known. He was the leader, and his buddy, Mort Joseph, was the co-leader. In those days, if you started a group, you owned it. It was yours. Until someone strong enough came along and booted you out and took over. Now, really, that's the way it was. They got booted out, but it took 2 years. They hung on fiercely for 2 years. Thank God they did. I just loved them to death. I just loved them to death. And so I sat there with my red turban on, wondering what was going to happen to me, and I was just looking down at the floor, and I'd look up just every now and then, because this nervous tic was driving me crazy. And he said, "This is the regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who gather together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever." And I died. I thought, what an order. I can't go through with that. Forever? It just jarred me. I can't explain to you how bad that was. I didn't want to be a phony and tell him, no, it can't be that way. I can't do that, you know. So, of course, I wasn't saying anything anyway. They didn't even know I existed, probably. And then he said, before we start the regular meeting, as is our custom, the women will have to leave. And I looked all around there, and there were about 12, 13 men, and I was so nervous, you know, I hadn't paid much attention to who was there, and I was it. I was the only woman. And I thought, he means me. He is throwing me out. He means me. And I got up crying, and I went through that door just about that far, too. And outside there, I just wept and cried and carried on and had tantrums and just had fits. And there my extremely well-dressed husband sat with his arms folded and stern-faced. Never had a short beer in his life. And I waited out there. I didn't know. I thought that there was some mistake. They'd call me right back in when they knew who I was or what if I... But nothing happened. I just stood out there, and the meeting went on and on. And when I say on and on, they only had one meeting in California, and they talked until they got tired. It wasn't like from 8 to 9:30 now, or 8:30 till 10, or anything like that. They just talked till they got ready to quit. And that was about it. So I waited, and I thought I would never, never live through it. And the door came out with Dick, and I thought, I finally made up this little story in my head that sounded real and made it possible for me to bear it. I thought, they are in there discussing my case with him, and I figured, well, they're all doctors, that's what they are, they're doctors, and he is telling them my symptoms, how I threw up, and how I never could make it home, and how I'd wrecked the car, and how some total strangers would bring me home, and how one time I had to crawl home, two blocks from the nearest bar. And my nylons, well, I don't think I had nylons then. Whatever stockings I was wearing were hanging out in back of me. They had come off as I crawled up the steps of my house, the big, long, stringy things full of holes. And I was just a rotten mess, and I thought maybe I just couldn't qualify. I was so bad. But eventually he came out, and I said, well, I figured it out. They're doctors, and they've given you a prescription that'll cure me. He said, Sib, you don't know what I've been through. He said, every last one of them made a long talk, and they all kept looking at me. They never took their eyes off me. They figured they had a new baby, and they hadn't had many because, you see, my letter was written early on, and they hadn't had that big bunch of mail, and they thought he was a newcomer, so they just really gave him all the good shots they possibly could. And so I just died. I just started screaming and hollering and whooping and said, take me home, take me home. It's all a bunch of baloney, and I thought I was going to get some help. And he took me home, and he jumped out of the car, and I just got under the steering wheel and went to the bar about four blocks away and got roaring drunk. And I got mad and madder and madder at my treatment. And then I remembered that in my purse, I would remember that, was this letter from New York written by Ruth Hawk. I had taken that down there, and I had practiced a little speech. And I was going to say, when I walked in, I thought it would be kind of like it is here, and that the leaders would be like there. And I would go up to one of them and say, pardon me, sir, are you the leader? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, I am. Well, here's my letter of authorization from your home office in New York. And in it, if you will be kind enough, sir, to read it, you will find that I'm entitled to all the considerations of your club. And this is my letter. You may keep it or give it back to me as you wish, but at least it proves that I am entitled to be here. And I'd make it over and over and over so it'd sound good. But never got a chance, see. But now I remembered the letter, and in it I remembered that it said, P.S. If you are in need of immediate help, please call Cliff Walker, because he will answer any call for help from an alcoholic. And he works nights, so you may call him any time at all. Well, the bartender had thrown me out for misbehaving, which wasn't unusual. And I was standing out there on the sidewalk, and there was a payphone. And I thought, now's a good time to call Cliff Walker. And I'll really tell him what I think about their Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I put a nickel in the telephone,
phone.
And Cliff answered. He answered the phones for AA for 4 years before we had money enough to open a central office in Los Angeles. And I told him what my name was. I said, I'm Sybil Maxwell, and I went down to your lousy club tonight, and they threw me out. He said, oh, no, they didn't. I said, yes, they did. I have your name here from Ruth Hawk from the General Service Headquarters, and she told me to call you if I needed help, and now's the time. I need it. He says, but you're drunk. I said, of course. Of course I am. I said, I wasn't, though, when I went down there, and they threw me out. He said, they wouldn't have done that. They would not have done that. I said, but they did. They said, all the women have to leave. But listen, Sib, please listen to me just a minute. He said, they've never had a woman alcoholic before. And he said, some of the wives go down there, and they're quite used to that remark from the leader at a certain point. They come on in and sit down with their husbands. And then when they say, will the women all please leave, they know to go out there with their knitting or whatever and talk about their husbands or whatever. There was no Al-Anon or anything. And they were comfortable with that. They got to sit in the meeting for a while, so they, you know, like we do. And he said, they thought that you were the wife of your husband, see? Would you buy that? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, go down there next Friday and I'll pave the way for you because I'm a milkman and I can't go nights anymore. I have to have a meeting every Sunday afternoon at my house here. And he said, you're welcome to come over. I'll give you the address. And I said, well, I don't have a pencil. Let that go. And he said, I'll call them and fix it up and they will just be so pleased to see you. And so I went down. And I just couldn't believe that I would have ever done that at all. Because of my humiliation. I felt so unwanted and so unneeded and had felt that way so many years. But I think the reason that I did go back that following week is that my brother Tex came over, whom I adored. He was the drunk that I drank with, and he was the drunk that I bailed out of jail. And he and I were two of a kind, and he came over and he picked up that Saturday Evening Post and read it, and he read that letter from Ruth, and he said, Sib, he said, you're a chump. He said, you mean to tell me, he said, that's a racket. You're a simpleton if you think there's anything like that. He said, that's a racket. They're out to get your dough. I said, no, Tex, no, really. It's not that way. And I was taking up and saying all the good things about AA, and he was knocking it down. He says, I'll lay you 8 to 5 that every one of those bozos are drunk today. I said, they're not. They're not drunk. They're sober. That's why I went down there. And he says, well, I'm just going to prove it to you. He says, now you understand I'm not an alcoholic like you. I never was as bad as you. But I'm going to go down there next Friday, and if I prove it to you that they're just a bunch of jerks and that they're out to get your dough, will you believe me? I said, Tex, please don't go. Oh, Tex, let me do this. Please let me do this by myself. Please don't go to AA. Can you imagine that? Try it sometime on somebody in your family or some friend that is dying. Say, well, it's too bad I got to go to an AA meeting, but you can't go. The hell I can't. And that's just about the way it was with Tex. And so the following Friday night, I'm waiting at my house, and my brother, who had the brains and the ability to make $1 million and lose it within 6 months, gambling and drinking, and going down to Tijuana, he could make money during the Depression you wouldn't believe. He owned a Lone Star Rancho, a dairy, and I worked for him there, and he lost that and had to go through bankruptcy. And at the time, in 1941, he was broke again, but he could always make money. It never worried him that he was out of business. He just started a new one, you know. He had that ability. And so now, at this particular juncture, he's not having a very high-class job. He has a truck, and it's a vegetable truck, and he's filling it with watermelons and cantaloupes and garden vegetables or whatever is in season. And he goes down there on Produce Row at 4th and Stanford and loads up with that stuff. And then the winos work for him out in the communities, going door to door and selling the stuff. And he's making a good living doing that, you see, for that particular time in 1941. So this Friday night, I was absolutely embarrassed to tears. He pulled up in front of my house in that old vegetable truck, and there were 11 winos standing in the back. And his answer was that he could never get a full crew because they were always drunk, and if this thing was any good, if there was that chance that it turned out to be okay, he could sober them up, and he says, well, I'll have another fortune in 6 months. So here we go. I get up in front in the cab of the truck, and we go down with the mother group. It wasn't much bigger than the week before because the impetus of the Saturday Evening Post hadn't really hit, and it really wasn't that much bigger. They no longer sat around the table. And there was Tex, me, and the 11 winos. And he'd look at him, and he'd look at him. And pretty soon, Frank Randall began to talk. And I couldn't understand what he was talking about. I wonder if a newcomer who's sick and also scared and afraid of being thrown out again and all that, I wonder if they could hear anything about the program except the fact that here's a lot of people doing something they want to do. And that's enough, you know, for them. Because that's about the way it was with me. I didn't understand what he was reading out of that big book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path and the 12 steps and all that. I don't remember hearing that at all. I was too worried about Tex and that I was afraid Tex, who was such a strong personality, would right in the middle of it raise his hand and say, I beg to differ with you, my good sir. Now, my impression of that is so-and-so. And I thought he'll humiliate me so that I can't ever come back. But he was very quiet, very quiet. And so were the winos, and so was I. You can believe that. And my eyes were so bloodshot, and my twitch was twitching, and I was just sick with apprehension. But then, long towards the last, and I thought pretty AA talk, beautiful, beautiful AA talk he made. I didn't listen because I was thinking about all the things that could happen to us if they would let us stay. After a while, Frank said, excuse me, folks, and he went out off the stage and came back with this huge carton full of mail, letters from New York that had been forwarded, letters like mine that had been received the following week, letters that Ruth Hawk had then mailed to California, to the California group to answer. They were all 12-step calls, and they were bundled up geographically, depending upon where they came from. For instance, the beaches would be in one big stack. The beaches, you know, from Laguna clear down to San Pedro. And then Pasadena, in the Pasadena area, would have a big rubber band around that, maybe 15 or 20 of them. Whittier, you name it, Westwood, the south end of town, north end of town. And so it went according to the area. And Frank said, now hear this, you jokers. Oh, he was a wonderful guy. God, if I hadn't been married, I'd have fallen in love with him. I really would have. The way he talked, it was just enthralling. He said, hear this, you jokers. Any of you who've been sober 15 minutes, come on up here and get these 12-step calls. He said, I've got them all categorized here according to the town and the county. Now, I have a big bundle here from Riverside County. Is there anyone here from San Bernardino or Riverside or anywhere like that? And a guy in the back raised his hand and said, here. Oh, he said, that's you, Kent. Kent Hayden, come on up here. Get this bundle of 12-step calls and make them down there in Riverside County and bring those drunks up here next Friday, because if you don't, some of them can die. This is a killer disease. Don't forget it. If you take the letters, be sure you ring those doorbells and bring those guys down here. And then pretty soon he'd say, Burbank. And somebody'd say, here, come on up here. And he'd get a big bunch. The southeast area, the southwest area, Long Beach, and so forth. And I'm listening. It's fascinating, that part of it, to think that they're going to all go ring those doorbells and somebody come to the door and say, did you write this letter? So anyhow, he got down to the last stack, and I'm just fascinated. I'm having a good time. And then he got to the last stack, and he says, I've saved this big stack here to the last because they're all from women. All from women. And I understand we have a woman alcoholic here that an unfortunate thing happened. She was here last week, but we didn't know she was alcoholic. But Cliff called me and said she'd be down here tonight. He said, are you Sybil Maxwell? And I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. He said, come on up here, Sybil. Well, now, do you think anybody scared like that could do that? Get up and do what he said? I didn't know what he's going to do to me or for me or anything. And I just sat and looked miserable. He said, I said, come on up here, Sybil, please. Well, I did, and I went up there and I looked way up at this man, and he said, these letters are all from women, and they're letters just like yours. And I've read them all, and they all need help.
And you're the first woman alcoholic. It's your responsibility, if you want to stay sober and belong to this group, that you have got to go and ring those doorbells, talk to those women, and bring them all down here next Friday. Can you do that? And I said, no, sir. And he said, why not? He looked way down at me. I said, because I'll be drunk next Friday. I said, I don't want to be, but I always have been. I've never been sober that long, not in 17 years. And I said, no one's told me what you're doing to stay sober. Surely there's something you're doing to stay sober. I liked what you had to say, but there must be something to it that will keep a person sober. And nobody's told me anything about what to do tomorrow, so I won't buy another bottle. And that was a fact, you know. I wonder if a newcomer wonders about stuff like that. I sure did. I said, is it some kind of a miracle that you're telling me about? And he said, yes, I like that word. Let's just say that is a miracle. And I'll explain it a little bit to you, Sybil. He said, there was a guy named Bill, and you've come to know him because he's going to come out here and visit us pretty soon. And he wanted to quit drinking, and he tried hard, and he couldn't. And he decided that he'd like to communicate with someone who would understand what he was talking about. And so every time that he'd see a drunk, he would talk to him and try to get the guy to join with him and coming over and visiting back and forth and trying to plan some way to where they could stay sober together, but the guy wouldn't hold still for it and would go away. And Bill worked with 75 drunks, just talking to him and saying, look, I'm dying of booze, and so are you. Let's hang together and do something about it. And none of them did. And finally, Bill went home to Lois, his wife, and said, Lois, nobody's interested. Not a human being. I've talked to all my associates that I had in Wall Street. I've talked to strangers, and I've talked to people everywhere about the ideas that I picked up from the Oxford group, and nobody will hold still for it. They just look at me like I'm crazy or something, and not a human being has said that they will join with me in doing this thing that I'm trying to do, so I'm just a failure, that's all. I'm giving it up. And Bill said, Lois said, Bill, stop right there. You're not a failure, dear. You're not a failure. Do you realize that you haven't had a drink in 6 months? That's longer than any time since we've been married. You haven't had a drink. And Bill thought for a moment and he said, by golly, Lois, you got a point there. That's right. I feel good when I'm talking to those guys. I guess I'll just go on with what I'm doing for a while anyway. And so it wasn't long after that he went to Akron, and I'm telling you the story that you probably know as well or better than I do. He met Dr. Bob, and now he really did have one, see. And that was a happy day. 855 Ardmore. Ardmore, with my Texas accent. 855 Ardmore. Bob and I went to Akron there and talked, and then we went to 855 Ardmore to a deserted house here not many years back. And I picked some blades of grass off that empty house of Dr. Bob's, and big long blades of grass. And I took them home, and I gave all of my babies a blade of grass from Dr. Bob's lawn. Very childish sounding, but I really was so touched. I can't begin to tell you. It'd been empty a long while. And so it was that it was just unbelievable that he said, the thing is, Sib, he said, the miracle of it is that we all talked to Dr. Bob and they stayed sober together, and the two of them talked to somebody else and they stayed sober, and they found that there was a common bond of understanding between alcoholics that's not between the non-alcoholic and the alcoholic. And so they liked being with each other. They liked it or they wouldn't have done it. They enjoyed it, and they finally worked out some principles that they try to use together in their daily lives, and were growing fast. And he said, so now it's out here in California, and we're going to grow, and we're going to continue to grow, and you can make it too, because it isn't going to be that hard for you. They did it, so we can do it. So he said, the main thing is, for you right now, is to get your mind off yourself and try to think about saving a human life. Because if you're not willing to do what the rest of these people in this group are doing, going and ringing those doorbells, and saying, did you write a letter asking for help with a drinking problem? If you're not willing to do that, I don't know, I can't tell you what's going to happen to your life as an alcoholic. But if you're willing to do that, remember, that's all Bill had when he first started this thing, talking to other alcoholics. He didn't have a book to read. He didn't have 12 steps. He didn't have anything but a desire to talk to another alcoholic that he could communicate with him. And they could communicate with each other, and that's the way they started for a long time. And it worked then, without anything, without a book, without the 12 steps. And that's what you'll be doing, because one alcoholic understands another better than any other human being on earth. And so now, would you deny these women who've written these letters here the same privilege that you had in coming to this meeting if you think it? He says, look at this little crowd here. They're all sober. He said, Mort here's got almost a year. He's got 9 months. Cliff Walker here has 4 months. And he said, and I will have a year in December and so on. And he says, that's a long time for people who spent most of their time in jail, separated from their wives and no jobs or anything. So I said, but what'll I tell them when I get there? He said, all you do is ring that doorbell, and when that gal opens the door, hold up her letter. She'll know her handwriting. And say, did you write a letter asking for help with a drinking problem? She'll look at that letter and say, well, yes, I did. Say, well, I wrote one like that last week, and they answered mine, and they told me to come see you. Now, I don't know what they're doing. I went down there and looked them over. And they all looked happy, and they were laughing and everything, and they sure are sober. But they didn't get around to telling me how they're doing it, so why don't you come with me, and we'll find out together. He said, that's a 12-step call. Oh, I said, I can do that. So that's what I did. And it was the easiest thing I ever did. And, you know, you just have no idea the blessing that it was to see 3 days go by and a week go by and then 9 days sober. I was bragging. Everybody I could see, I'd say, I've got 9 days. The most important thing in my life. I hadn't remembered being sober 9 days before. And it was just terribly important. So the gals began to come in. And I want to say that right now that... Is that... I'm looking at that right, aren't I? See, 2 years ago I was supposed to have my eyes operated on and I could see perfectly, but I just don't do it. I'm just not... Well... I just don't find time to go down there and have them fixed. I'll do it when I get home, I promise that. So I would do that. I would ring those doorbells, and then we'd go and get those girls, and we'd bring them down. And pretty soon the fellow said, why don't you girls rent the room across the hall here and meet by yourselves? And so I did that. And I found that it was so easy to ring a doorbell and have the girls say, yeah, I wrote a letter. I got to have help. They've taken my kids away from me, and I'm not able to work and all of that. And I'm telling my story. But I would hold back part of it. It was a long time before I felt free to tell it like it was. I had the fear they wouldn't love me. I had the fear they wouldn't want me if they just knew that a girl who had been trained as a legal secretary during the Depression, that I had worked in a taxi dance hall for about 2 or 3 nights, and that a rich fella came in. I had this little baby girl that's now in AA, and I had to support her, and this rich fella bought a big... all the tickets for the evening, and he danced with me, and he'd take me out in the other room where they serve pitchers of beer for a buck, and I'd get 50 cents off every pitcher, but he didn't know it. I got to drink, and I got to drink free and make 50 cents besides, and he danced all evening with me, and I got a crying jag, and I told him about my sorry lot in life. I'm a legal secretary, and now look at me. Here I am. I got a little baby, and my mother's keeping her, and I hate this. I think it was my first or second night there. Oh, he said, oh, you poor little thing. You don't belong in a joint like this. He said, fortunately for me, the things you don't have, I have. I have money. I'm single. I love children. So he said, you won't need to work here. You just don't need to do that at all. He says, I'll adopt your child, and I'll be a good father to her, so let's get married. And I said, let's do. So So we got married, and he adopted my daughter, Addie, the one I was telling you that lives in Hollister, who's now 54, and he was a marvelous, marvelous man. Just a marvelous man. Came from an extremely good family. And the goose hung high, and I thought nothing bad could ever happen to me. My brother Tex developed a very bad heart ailment, and he didn't get along with the boys downtown. They thought that Tex Adams was just acting not according to the way those dignified gentlemen down at the mother group were acting, and they didn't much want him to come down there with all of his winos and everything, and he just snickered at them and said, "I'll just come as long as I want to, folks, but I'll tell you what, it won't be for long because I'm tired of only going once a week Friday nights. I'm going to start a group out in Huntington Park, which is near where I live. Makes more sense." They said, "You mean that you would start another group? You'd be disloyal to the mother group that gave you your sobriety?" "Yeah," he said, "yeah, I would do that." And he said, "I'll keep on coming down here and bringing my gang with me." "Well, we don't want you down here." And they said, "As a matter of fact, we heard a rumor you were about to start a group, so we had Joe here, who is an attorney, draw up some papers and incorporate AA in California. Now, that'll stop you." And Tex laughed and laughed and laughed. He said, "Do you mean to tell me that you really think you can incorporate this program and prevent other people from starting groups?" He said, "You've got to be crazy." He said, "You might as well try to incorporate a sunset." He said, "AA's like a sunset. Everybody can see the sunset and use the sunset and enjoy the sunset. And that's the way it'll be with AA." He said, "I'll lay it 8 to 5 that we'll have groups all over this county within 6 months." And, of course, that's true. My home group now, Wednesday night in Pasadena, and the hole in the ground that Tex started in 1941, still going strong. They held a marathon there 2 weeks ago for 3 days and nights. And Bob was one of the speakers. Oh, he led the meeting, and I talked. And you wouldn't believe that around the clock they had a huge crowd every night. Why they will go, I don't know, day and night, for 3 days and nights, a marathon. The first one they'd ever had, but it won't be the last because those people just can't get enough of it. They like it. And isn't it a good thing that we like it? Because otherwise nobody could push us here, force us here. The judge can for a brief time, maybe, but outside of that, why, we just leave it. We wouldn't like it. We'd drink again. We'd die. That would be about the way it was. But the rough times came, and I must say that I found out that Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't be worth a plug nickel to me if it was only good when the sun was shining and the birds were singing, and it was just like one big holiday. It works under any circumstances, is what I'm trying to say. It just impresses me so much when I see some member that has gone through I'm not happy for them that they've gone through a long trial of perhaps bankruptcy or losing their business or a death in the family or things that happen to human beings out there, not necessarily AA members. I'm not happy about that. But they stay sober and manage it beautifully, just beautifully. And I never think of myself of being able to handle a major crisis and handle it beautifully. I've had some, and I may not have handled it beautifully, but I've never had to get drunk. I've never considered drinking because of AA, because I adopted the thought when I got sober after a bit that AA was like a medicine. A medicine that would sustain me and keep me sober all my life, because they had taught me that it was on an all-time basis, and it was a long time before they ever mentioned a 24-hour program or a day at a time. But there have been times in my life when the rough things, the bad things that would happen, that I wouldn't consider drinking, but I didn't care to live at that moment. And I just lived a heartbeat at a time. A heartbeat at a time will do it if you can't do any better. I don't mean drinking, I mean just living. A heartbeat at a time if it's rough, a minute at a time, an hour at a time, a day at a time, and so forth. And that's the way it will be. But you will find the most joy, the most happiness in AA that the everyday folks never even dreamed existed. For instance, my dearest brother on earth, Clyde, who lives this normal life, whatever a normal life is like without AA, sounds dull to me. But anyway, that's the way it is with him, and he's extremely happy, and of course doesn't know anything about AA. And there are many people dying tonight because they don't know about AA. You'd think, well, how could that be with so much publicity and favorable publicity? They write about us all the time in the newspapers, but yet there are drunks out there that don't know where to go, and they don't know what to expect when they get here. And then when they get here and they find that we're friendly, and they will hang around. I used to think that because the leader said that we were there on an all-time basis without any mental reservations whatsoever, I accepted that in my mind, that it was an all-time basis, because I didn't know any other way to think. And it was so long before I discovered that you can do it a heartbeat at a time, or an hour at a time, or a day at a time, as long as you don't take the first drink. And it works that way, too. About the worst thing that happened to me at that time, and isn't it strange that when a bad thing's happening to you, you think it's the worst thing that ever happened, that you've never had anything bad happen before. That fellow that I was married to, I came home from the meeting one night, and he had been getting stranger and stranger. I hadn't been sober too many years. And he had gotten to where he didn't smile very much, and he pouted a lot. And he never did drink, and he came from this fine family, and he never did understand really alcoholism. My house was full of AA members often. My brother Tex was there a lot, but I could get him to go to AA at Christmas when we'd have a special thing, you know, or a big dinner or a banquet. And he was very polite, but pretty soon I'd see him standing over in the corner just looking miserable. And he just couldn't join in, sit down, laugh, or even pretend to like it. But he would go twice a year for my sake if it was a special event. And so he began to ask me not to go to the meetings. And I would just pass it off as a remark, you know, and I'd say, well, okay, I'll cut down on them, you know, for your sake. But I couldn't seem to, because Susie would say that Mary was going to be there and that she had a new girl with her, or whatever was going to happen, I had to be there and I'd go. And he began to put the pressure on, and I noticed that. And he'd been so good to my little daughter, and she had by this time married at 16 and was not at home any longer. And he began to put more pressure on them. And he'd be standing by the door when I would come home from a meeting, and this is what he'd say with his chin jutted out. Again? Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Dick. I did promise you I wouldn't go to, this week. I promised you I wouldn't go, but I just had to because of this and that and the other thing. And every time I come home from a meeting, he'd be sitting in the rocking chair. I can hear it squeak in. Squeak, squeak, squeak. So you're home, huh? Yeah, yeah. Well, when are you going to cut this out? And he wouldn't let go for a moment. He just kept that up. And I was always running over and kneeling down, putting my head in his lap and saying, I mean it, honey. I won't go next week. I really won't. I promise. And I meant it, but I did. And I kept it right up. Then I came home one night, and he opened the door, and he was almost laughing. He was smiling. He said, come on in, honey. I got good news. Oh, I said, what is it? What is it? He said, well, let's go in the living room and turn on the lights and talk about it. I said, fine. What is it? And I went in the living room, and he turned on the lights, and he said, I couldn't wait for you to get home from the meeting to tell you this, because you're going to like it. It's going to work. What? He said, why don't you go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, and I'll take care of you. He says, anything will be better than this. I couldn't believe it. I can't tell you the shock that ran through me. I stood there. I felt like I had turned to stone. And I didn't speak or cuss him out, and I had a bad temper. I still do at times when it's necessary. I didn't blow it. I didn't do anything to put myself in the wrong. I just stood there. Go back to drinking like in the good old days, and he'd take care of me. And so he finally went upstairs to bed, and I thought, things have been getting worse and worse, and he's a great guy, and I can't quit AA. I'll get drunk. That's the way it is. I can't quit. So I have to leave. And I went upstairs, and I got a suitcase. And I just took what I could out of the bedroom, just temporary stuff, I guess, and crammed it in there. And I looked in my purse to see if I had much money. I didn't have much. And my car was in the driveway, nice, gleaming, black, new car. He could afford to buy me anything I wanted. And I thought, he saved my life, really. And he adopted my daughter. She's married now, and if I have to quit AA, I'll get drunk and I'll be dead in 6 months or a year, and I can't do that. I cannot do that. So I got my little suitcase, and I went out, and I started to get in the car, and I thought, no, I'll make a clean break. I didn't have much when I married him, so I'll just leave the way it is. And I caught a streetcar down to Adams and Figueroa, and there's some old mansions down there, and they have signs out in front, housekeeping rooms for rent. And I rented one. It had a gas plate, and the bathroom was across the hall, and the bedroom and living room combined for about 14 a week or whatever it was. And I went out the next morning, and I got a job at the Times newspaper. I'd worked on a newspaper before. In fact, I'm a Jill of all trades. I was a real estate broker and a taxi dancer and working on the newspaper and many, many, many other jobs. But anyway, that's what I did, and I got this crummy room, and I never looked back. I couldn't, because he was trying to kill me, but he didn't know that. There was no Al-Anon. I must point that out. I must point that out. No Al-Anon. No place that he could fit in. And when he would go to our Christmas parties or anything and stand off in a corner with his arms folded just to please me, he was so miserable. And his mother came to town to visit us often from San Diego. And she would say, "My son never had to put up with anything like this in his life." And that didn't help me much either. And so that was the end of that marriage. And I couldn't do anything else but that at all. It just had to be. And I was sad about it, and I really did feel bad. But I went to work, and life went on, and I continued to go to the hole in the ground. And then my brother became ill. In the meantime, I had taken the money that I'd made in real estate, and I bought a... Now, this sounds... I'm not making this up. I bought a boxing and wrestling arena in Santa Ana. The reason was that my brother Tex had once been a promoter for a boxing and wrestling arena, and had been a wrestler at one time, and he knew the ropes real well. So I made the investment, and he was my manager. And we made money hand over fist, just lots of money, and we had the concession for the pop and the peanuts and the popcorn. That is where the money is. The admissions just pay the nut, and the money is in the refreshments and the hot dogs and stuff. And we had gorgeous George and the whole bunch. And amateur boxing on Tuesday and wrestling on Thursdays. And I was busy, and it was late, and there were no freeways, and I wouldn't get home until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. This was twice a week, and it really took its toll. And I worked extremely hard at it, and I wasn't going to quite as many meetings, and I wasn't as happy as I might have been on account of that thing. Well, all right, then TV comes along. I don't know the year that it came along, but you know the inevitable. Every living human being stayed home and looked at boxing and wrestling on TV. And I was stubborn, and I wouldn't give up. So I would go down there and open up that big stadium with those employees and get the necessary popcorn and drinks and hot dogs, and nobody would come, maybe 200. Or you're not going to be able to pay the expenses on that. And so after a few weeks, a few months of that, I locked the door and walked away from that and sold the arena and everything in it for $1,200 just for the lumber. And that was that. And I had to go through bankruptcy again and go get a job as a secretary, which I was always pretty good at. So just because we become members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was relieved and happy when it happened. Felt good. I knew it was going to happen, and just waiting for it to happen was the painful part. But when I gave it up and got a job in an office again and didn't owe anybody anything and had a salary coming in, it was good. It was very good. But when Tex developed this heart ailment, he developed it when he was managing the arena for me. And Dr. Unger came out of the dressing room one night, and he said, "Your brother won't be able to make it very much longer." He said, "He's got a real bum heart. He came to my office today, and I don't think he'll be able to make it very much longer." And he didn't. He died within a few months, and I didn't take it very well. And so I wrote to Bill Wilson finally. I couldn't talk to the people at the hole in the ground. They'd say, "How are you, Sid?" And I'd say, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm just fine." And they'd know I was lying, you know, but I just couldn't tell them how I was hurting. I seemed to just hurt, a physical hurt. I can't explain it. But I missed him so terribly, so dreadfully. We had been through so much together in the arena and at the hole in the ground. His coming in April 17th, I came in March 23rd. He started going, and he was such an inspiration to the new guys. The guys that were out of jail all went out there to see him because he'd hand them some Bull Durham and take them out in the kitchen and feed them some Mulligan stew and newcomers meetings for them. And he had a talent that I could never possess if I lived to be 200. So I was desperately lonely, and I was really miserable for quite a long spell there. And my marriage going on the rocks, and that wasn't a very happy situation either. But I didn't think of drinking because there was the hole in the ground and all the people that were just like relatives to me. I could go to the meetings there. Sometimes I would just be there and not hear all the words they were saying. But when they'd say, "How are you, Sib?" and I'd say, "Oh, I'm fine. How are you?" Really, don't ever do that. If you are as miserable as I was, say, "I'm miserable." And I've learned to do that. If I'm sad, "How are you, Sib?" "Oh, rotten." "What's the problem?" "Well, I'll tell you." You know, it took me a long time, that pride of mine, to just turn loose and say, "No, I'm not good at all. Everything is just going to pot." Because sometimes it does in people's lives. Just because we're alcoholics and sober doesn't mean that it's always going to be good. Sometimes we're out of a job. Sometimes we spend too much money. Sometimes we're sick. Sometimes we have marital problems. All the problems that the guy next door has who never had a drink in his life. I was slow to learn the steps. Because I was staying sober on being a woman alcoholic who was given enough attention to keep me happy, as most of you are too. I'm sure that if people didn't kind of baby you and take you to meetings when you were new, you wouldn't feel wanted. I felt wanted, and I felt needed, and it fulfilled a gap that I never had in my drinking life. I never did have many friends when I was drinking, maybe one or two or something like that, drinking friends that would come and they would go, and they would come and they would go. And so going to AA and being, and these are my words, Frank Randall down at the mother group, when the women started coming in, he said, "Sib, I'm putting you in charge of all the women that come in." And I listened and I said to myself, "Sybil's in charge. Sybil's in charge." Can't beat that. Here I was thrown out of this group last week because they didn't know I was an alcoholic, and now I came back and he's putting me in charge the very next week. My goodness. So I would tell you what to do, and I would give you this 12-step call, and I'd say, "You report back to me next Friday. Let me know how it turned out. I'll give you that 12-step call." And I had my book in it with the name of all the women that had called up. And so I would give them the calls to you. You'd report back to me. I'd write it in my little book. I'd show it to the leader, and he'd say, my, you're doing a good job, Sib. You're just doing a good job." And it kept me sober. It made me feel good. But I don't know how this story tonight would have ended if I hadn't heard this one thing one night. And then I'm going to sit down. One night, there was a fellow named Joe walked up to my brother Tex at the hole in the ground. And the crowd was kind of shifting around, drinking coffee and getting ready to go, and most of them had. And he said, "Listen, Tex, I'm about the only guy in this group that gets drunk all the time." He said, I don't mind admitting that. He said, "I come back and I get drunk, and I come back and I get drunk. So I've decided that I've missed one of the steps." So he says, "Tex, you're a smart guy, and you've been leading this group a long time. I just want you to tell me what step I've missed so that I can do it. I'm willing. If I've missed one of them, just tell me flat out which step have I missed and why do I keep getting drunk." Tex says, his heart was very bad at that time. He said, "Look at the cigarette smoke in here. I can't talk to you here, Joe, and all the people babbling. Wait till they go home, and let's sit out on the steps." It was July or August, and he lived with me at that time. And he says, "My sister Sib and I'll go out there on the steps, and we'll just talk, and then I'll find out what step you're missing." So he said, "Let's do that." So I sat here, and Tex sat there, and Joe sat here out on the steps, and Tex said, "So you can't figure it out, huh, Joe? Well, let's take the first one where we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable." He said, "You know, I think maybe that was part of your trouble. You have never admitted that your life was unmanageable. You're always bragging about the big job that you have and how you bought the new car and how you and your wife get along and you just act like that there was nothing wrong with your life. You even act like it was a kind of a pleasure to drink. You don't act like you drank too much or got into too much trouble. Your story doesn't sound like mine or my sis's or Harry's in there or any of those. You just kind of seem to me like you're just coming along for the ride. You haven't really admitted that your life is unmanageable, was unmanageable, still unmanageable. So you get drunk, you see?" Joe said, "So that's it, Tex. Thanks a lot." And he jumped up. Tex grabbed him by the coattail and said, "Sit down, Joe. I've just started." Now, when we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, we mean it. We came to believe, and that's exactly why they put came, and they didn't say we did believe. A lot of us came in here and we didn't believe in anything. We didn't even believe in ourselves. By the process of coming to this meeting, over some length of time, different for others, we came to believe that there was some power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. It didn't happen maybe at the first meeting. We came to believe, and that's why it's worded that way. Do you get it, Joe? You have never admitted that step. Came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. You think you're perfectly sane, was perfectly sane, that you could knock it off any time you wanted to, and so you couldn't do it. And so there you go. You were in a position where you couldn't even tackle the third one that follows it, which said we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, he said, a lot of the guys at the hole in the ground get mixed up on that. They think it says, instead of making a decision, they'll say, well, I've taken the third step. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand him. It doesn't say that we turned our will and our lives over to the care of God. It says we made a decision to do it. For instance, Joe, if I told you that I've made a decision to go up to Big Bear Lake and fish next week, and then I would come to the meeting next Thursday and I'd say, hey, Joe, you know what? I made a decision to go up to Big Bear and fish. And suppose the third week I'd come back and say, hey, Joe, you know I made a decision to go up. He says, I'd never get anywhere. Suppose I said I was going to San Francisco. I made a decision to go. I'd have to catch a bus or take a train or take a plane or hitchhike, wouldn't I? I could sit here the rest of my life and say I'm going to San Francisco. That step doesn't say it's already accomplished. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our life. Big difference, he said, because a lot of us who first come to meetings don't believe in a higher power. A lot of us who first come to AA don't believe in anything, in themselves, or in any higher power, even if they did when they were a child. And some of them who come to AA in the beginning are atheists and positively don't believe in anything but the group or working with others or what have you. And so he says, you haven't made the faintest effort to take that third step because I've known you a long time. Is that true, Joe?
Yes, Tex.
Now he said, look here. In the book, it says, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And it says, searching and fearless. And then further along, it'll explain about it, how we wrote it down. And because it says, we made a list. We made a list. And he says, you can't make a list without a pencil. Not a big, long pencil. He says, you can take a little stub of pencil about 2 inches long and a postage stamp, if you were really willing to do something about your drinking. And you could just write down one thing that's bugging you and do something about it. And that would be an inventory. He says, you don't have to do it all today. He said, you tire yourself out. He says, people come to me with manuscripts full of everything that happened from the time they were born up until the time they got sober. Totally unnecessary. You can write down there that you're jealous. Do something about that. That you're full of fear. Do something about that. That you're an angry man, do something about that. Anything that's a defect of character that you're aware of now. And as you continue to stay sober, you'll turn up more things, become aware of more things. And you can add to that inventory. But to start and be willing to do something about it today and just write down one thing that's bugging you, do it. It'll help. You'll stay sober. And then you'll be in a position to take the next one. We admitted to ourselves, to God and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. He said, doesn't that make sense that that step would follow? Because until we made that inventory, we didn't know the exact nature of our wrongs. It follows right in line there. We made a list of all of our defects of character and then admitted to God and ourselves and another human being. Now he said, if you don't believe in God, he says, you know what I had to do because I've been away from church for 40 years when I got sober. I had to take this group as a higher power. I really did. I had to take the group of people that were sober. I wasn't. The book will do for a while. The group or anything like that. Just stay sober and it'll all come later because you've got the rest of your life to do it. And so don't make such a big deal out of it. He said, you do yourself an injustice. You really do. And when do we say that we admit our wrongs? He said, you don't have to admit them all because you've got time. You don't even know what they are yourself. He said, the sixth one, entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And when we speak of God again, I tell you that you can use anything you want to at this moment. And defects of character and wrongs are the same thing. Bill just told me that he said that he was a budding young author and he didn't want to use the same word over and over and over, so forget about that. And entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, he said, if it is an attitude of mind that you will get, that possibly you don't have now, that you're really ready to have these defects of character removed. He said, you make it so complicated that you just, when you read them, you think they're too hard, and they're really not. They're very sensible and practical, and you can do it. And then now that you've got that far, it's okay then, because you'll be feeling better than you do now, that we humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings. See? Shortcomings, defects of character, all one and the same thing. Bill said that he just did not want to repeat himself and use the exact same words. So that's that. Then, while you're taking your inventory, it would be a simple matter, made a list of all the people we'd harm and became willing to make amends to them all. It doesn't say you do it. It said your attitude has changed. And you've made this list, you've got it right there with your inventory. While you're doing that, you can write down one or two of the people you've harmed, because you won't remember them all right away anyway. You've got a lifetime to think about somebody else, and just do it. List the people you've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all when the opportunity presents itself. Don't put it off on purpose, but just do it as time goes by. And then you make direct amends to these people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or somebody else, and injure them or others. And he says that's just carrying out what you've just put down in the eighth step. See, he says no big deal. Continue to take this personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admitted it.
And he says, I don't have to give you any big explanation of that. That's just a continuation of four.
Tex said, now this one I'm getting to here was so hard for me that I had to let it go for a little bit while I was making 12-step calls and starting this group and talking to you drunks. But he said it was tough for me because it sounded religious to me at first, but it doesn't any longer. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. So Tex said, that's a long one, and it says a lot. But he says, you know what? I looked up the word meditation, and it only means good, clean thinking. And he said, a prayer I discovered for me had to be just a good thought for the guy or the gal sitting next to me saying, oh, I hope she makes it. Oh, I hope he makes it. He said, it can be just that simple. Now, and then as time goes by, change it as you change, because you will change if you stay sober. The 12th one, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps we've talked about, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and then to practice these principles in all our affairs. He said, that's what I've been trying to do with you, Joe, this last hour, really. I want you to stay sober more than you know. I really do. If any word that I've said tonight will help you stay sober, I'll be ever so grateful. And prayer, as I say, can be a good clean thought for another alcoholic. He said, and later on you'll say prayer because you like the word prayer. Maybe. A lot do, some don't. But what's the difference? We're in here to stay sober. And to practice these principles in all our affairs, we're doing it a day at a time, an hour at a time, at a heartbeat at a time. But if we do it, it can be for a lifetime. And later on, after Tex died, he died right there at the hole in the ground, and they called me down there while he was still there. I lived two blocks away. I remembered, I forgot that thing entirely. And long after Tex left us in October of 1952, it all played back. I never even talked about it at meetings. It played back just as it happened, sitting out there on the steps. And it every time I think about it, it gives me a fresh view of AA. I feel like a newcomer. I am a newcomer, and if anybody ever called me an old-timer, I'd want to poke them in the nose, but old-timers sometimes can get pretty boring, you know, and I want to come back here and see you people, and I do hope that you'll let me, because in this sense, I think this, that we're all newcomers, because AA itself is new, and in another sense, we're like little birds, just little birds, learning to fly. So as fledglings learning to fly, may the wings of your happiness never lose a feather. God bless you.